So actually, I have a double thank you for Rabbi Torchiner. Namely, first of all, the thank you for not only his shiur, which I just enjoyed alongside you, but also for all of his efforts in putting together this program, as well as the other members of the Beit Midrash, the Skan and the Avrechim. Bishus, all of you learning with us and those members of the Beit Midrash. Thank you so much for having me, Brishus, as well to the sponsors for tonight. It's nice to be back, even if I haven't really been gone for very long. I'm no longer an Avreich in the Beit Midrash full-time this year. I'm joining on for some things, but this is a nice way to kick off the year for sure. In terms of the dedications for tonight, first of all, this event is dedicated in memory of Ben Lax, Zichrono Livracha, Dov Ben Mordechai Zal, by his loving family. May his neshama merit from our learning. This year is also dedicated by a number of others, to which one of my thank yous to Rabbi Torchiner goes, to Karen and Rabbi Mordechai Torchiner, Carla and Jules Sulzbach, Esther and Bob Libman, Judith Todd Habo and Judah Habo, and Avraham Freilich, for the various reasons that they sponsored. Thank you very, very much for making this event possible. Just a quick public service announcement before I begin, is if you are in the Greater Toronto area and you haven't davened Mincha yet and you wish to do so, now is a great time to step out because she is rapidly approaching. The session is being recorded, as you can tell in the top left corner of your screen, and I'd be happy to share the recording with you afterwards if you miss it for that reason or for any reason for that matter. So let's kick things off. My title for today was about a postponed Sukkot. And the truth is, as you see, I've made a couple of notes in the source sheet. The source packet has been shared in the chat. I'm going to copy that again to share it in the chat one more time so you can access it by a link. Okay, that should be there. And I'm going to share my screen for most of the session with you. So, first, before we start, some of you, having read about a postponed Sukkot, may have thought of Yeravam ben Avad. Yeravam ben Avad in Malachim Aleph, chapter 12, at the end, actually keeps and celebrates, establishes, really, a Sukkot feast on the 15th of Cheshvan. So that definitely could have qualified being 1 month late for Sukkot. However, that's not what we're going to talk about today. We're going to move on a little bit later in Jewish history. And that is for when many of you who have been here for the entire morning session and then Rabbi Torchiner's session, and you've got so many more sessions all about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot and Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah. So I figured we could skip ahead a couple of months in the calendar and let's talk about Hanukkah. There's a very, very well-known question that's asked by Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Beit Yosef, in Orach Chaim 670. Tafresh Ayin. And it's a very, very famous question because it's been turned into somewhat of a Hanukkah Dvar Torah machine. There are various answers that have been suggested to this question, some of which are not really distinct from other answers. But the famous, famous question that he asks is, Lama Kavu Shmona Yamim? Beit Yosef says, why were there 8 days of Hanukkah? Why? Because based on the classic story that we have in the Gemara, which we will see in a little bit, there was enough oil, there was the miracle of the oil that we're celebrating, and there was enough oil to keep the lamps lit for 1 day, and the lamps burned for 8 days. So the Beit Yosef says, hey, I know how to do some math. 8 minus 1, because 8 were the number of days that it burned, and 1 was the day that we had enough fuel for, so that's only 7 days of miracle of oil. Why is it that we have 8 days of Hanukkah? To commemorate that, we should have 7 days of Hanukkah, says the Beit Yosef, because really the miraculous nature of the oil burning was only 7 days worth. So this is a very, very well-known question. As I mentioned, there are books that have collected literally tens and in some cases hundreds of suggestions to answer this question. Beit Yosef himself gives a couple of suggestions, I mean three. But I wanted to focus on one answer given by the Aruch HaShulchan to this question. And he says as follows, we'll read it inside source number 2, it should be up on your screen. Again, please let me know if there is any difficulty or issues. I should note we're on page 30 of the packet if you're following along in your own packet and not together with me on my screen. But here we are, source number 2, says the Aruch HaShulchan. Another reason for this, meaning answering the question of the Beit Yosef that there should have been only 7 days of Hanukkah celebration, not 8. This was explained in the book of Chashmonai, which is not immediately clear what that book is. We'll see in a moment. Lefisha al yedei hagzerot, that due to the decrees of the time, meaning the Yavanim, the Greeks, did not allow them to do all sorts of different religious practices. But lu az mila hakriv b'chag hasukot ha'avar u'bishmini atzeret. And what they had done is that they were unable to bring any sacrifices in the temple during the previous Sukkot and on Shmini Atzeret of that year. Therefore, when only a couple of months later, when they regained control of the temple and they were able to do as they wished in terms of bringing korbanot, v'lachin lezikaron zeh, as a memorial for this, as a remembrance for this, asu shmona yamim Chanukah, because says Aruch HaShulchan, based on the Sefer Chashmonai, Chanukah was actually modeled after Sukkot. Sukkot that year was not really celebrated properly. There was no way to do Korbanot, and as we'll see, there weren't really ways to perform any of the other mitzvot of Sukkot. And therefore, when they came to Chanukah time, they said, we've got to make up 8 days of celebrations that we missed on Sukkot. And therefore, and says the Aruch HaShulchan, something fascinating. How does this work together with the oil miracle? It seems to be distinct, says Aruch HaShulchan, no. Umimela kishe'aru lahem min hashamayim hanes shel hadlaka. And when Hashem showed them this miracle of the candles remaining lit on the menorah and the Beis HaMikdash, Her'um shehiskim al yadam la'asot shmona yamim. That was God showing the Jewish people, you did right by making an 8-day festival, and you should keep this up from year to year. And this idea that Hanukkah is modeled after Sukkot actually has a number of fascinating connections between Hanukkah and Sukkot that we see in various rabbinic sources. I actually took this chart from a shiur my wife gave at the end of, I think, at Simchat Torah last year. And here are a number of the connections. We're not going to go through all of them in detail, as we won't have the time for that, but just to hit some of the highlights. As we mentioned, both are 8 days long, and we recite the full Hallel on them, unlike other holidays. There are connections in terms of the heights at which we place some ritual objects of the festival. The menorah must be placed no higher than 20 amot, and the schach should not be more than 20 amot above the ground. There are some parallels in menorahs. Menorahs were lit in the Simchat Beit HaShoevah. That was the big celebrations that we had in the temple on Sukkot, and of course the main symbol of Hanukkah is that we light the Chanukiah. We strive on Hanukkah to do the mitzvah of lighting Mihadrin Min HaMahadrin, which corresponds to the language that we see with the etrog, which is called a Peri Eitz Hadar. It's the same root in Hebrew. One particularly well-known one, really the last two are both particularly well-known, is that the Talmud questions as to how the menorah should be lit. There's a famous debate between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel in the Talmud as to should one light candles in an ascending order, one candle on night one of Hanukkah, two candles on night two of Hanukkah, three candles on night three, etc., etc. Or there's the opinion of Beit Shammai, which says that actually we should begin with 8 candles, and then the second night move down to 7, third night 6, etc., etc., until we get to the 8th night having 1. And the Gemara asks, what are the rationales for each of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel? And the Gemara explains that Beit Shammai actually follows a model which is developed in the sacrifices and the offerings that we bring on Sukkot. The number of bulls brought on each day of Sukkot actually decreases by 1. Okay? So you can look that up. That's another very interesting connection that, again, there seems to be something in Hanukkah pattern after Sukkot. The deadline for bringing Bikurim and reading the Parsha of Bikurim is actually until Sukkot, but one can continue to bring the Bikurim without having the opportunity to read the accompanying passage even until Hanukkah, and there are more that other people put together. There's juxtaposition in the Torah between the lighting of the menorah and the holidays in Parshat Emor, various other connections. And this may be the reason for it. It's quite possible that Hanukkah was patterned after Sukkot because at that time the Jewish people were unable to properly keep Sukkot. So they postponed Sukkot, so to say, not that they performed every detail of the rituals of Sukkot on Hanukkah. We don't really see a record of them bringing, for example, the sacrifices of Sukkot on Hanukkah. That may not be so kosher. However, we do see that there was a definite celebration modeled after Sukkot, and here are some ways in which we see it. So, as we continue, the next source I brought you is Makabim Bet, which is one of the books that was not included in our canon. It's a historical book from after, written in times after we conclude our canon, and also not written with the same holiness by the same people that we like to include. But that's not our topic here today as to what's included in the Jewish canon. It's a book written sometime around the second half of the second century BCE, not long after the stories of Hanukkah take place, written in Greek, ironically. And here are some sources. It's known as Sefer HaMakabim. There's a Sefer HaMakabim Aleph, which may have been written in Hebrew. This is Sefer HaMakabim Bet, which is a separate work, as we said, written in Greek. So I brought you the New English translation of the Septuagint. Septuagint, although we use it to refer to the translation of the Torah into Greek by 70 sages or 72 sages, depending on different versions of the story, in general, it's viewed in the academic community to refer to the Greek writings that are parts of the Bible according to any traditions, including in this, we have a very early tradition of the Greek text of Maccabim Beth, which again, apparently it was written in. And so I brought you a more recent translation. This is a new academic translation, and there's a particular reason which I'm going to highlight when we read through it. So here I'm going to start with chapter 1, verse 8. You can see is the first part of source number 4. We prayed to the Lord and were heard, and we offered sacrifice and grain offering, and we lit the lamps and set out the loaves. And now see that you keep the days of the Feast of Tent Pitching in the month of Kislev. Okay, so number one, we see something called the Feast of Tent Pitching. Anybody want to give a guess as to what that might be? You can put it in the chat. You can unmute yourselves. What might the Feast of Tent Pitching be?
Sukkot?
It sounds like Sukkot, right? When we read that at first glance, we say Feast of the Tent Pitching. Sounds like the festival on which we pitch our tents. Okay, that's a fair reading. Let's continue. This unnamed festival comes again. By the way, if we do say that, this, which is being written to other communities, is telling them we should keep the Feast of Tent Pitching, which is Sukkot, in the month of Kislev. This is pretty direct, pretty clear, that we're saying that we are celebrating Sukkot to some degree in the month of Kislev. Now, nobody's suggesting that you uproot Sukkot from where it was for the future, but perhaps a festival patterned after Sukkot. But let's continue. 118, since we intend to celebrate the purification of the temple on the 25th of Kislev, we thought it necessary to notify you in order that you also may celebrate it as the Feast of Tent Pitching and of the Fire, given when Nehemiah built both the temple and the altar and offered sacrifices. Okay, so we're talking about, again, celebrating Hanukkah like the Feast of Tent Pitching and like a story with Nehemiah, which we're not going to get into now. And then, when we get to the actual retelling of the story in chapter 10 of Maccabim, that it says, and again, I'm reading the English translation based off the Greek, they celebrated it for 8 days with rejoicing in the manner of coverts, remembering how not long before, during the Feast of Tents, they had been inhabiting the mountains and caves like wild animals. Therefore, carrying ivy-wreathed wands and beautiful branches and also fronds of palm, they offered hymns of thanksgiving to him who had given success to the purifying of his own holy place. They decreed by public ordinance and by vote that the whole nation of the Judeans should observe these days every year. So what did they do to celebrate the first Hanukkah? They walked around with the Arba Minim, with the four species, as we refer to them, that we take on Sukkot. Again, were they actually celebrating Sukkot? It doesn't seem like it was a full celebration of Sukkot. We don't necessarily hear any more detail than just to say they celebrated in this manner, but there certainly was something modeled after Sukkot that took place not only in the first year when they did have the religious freedoms to celebrate their holidays as soon as that was possible. They kept Sukkot, again, to whatever degree. And furthermore, there seems to have been some sort of holiday patterned after Sukkot for years to come. So now I get back to that phrase which I asked you about the Feast of Tent Pitching and the Feast of Tents. The reason why I brought you this translation is because most other translations try to identify that day as one of two different Jewish celebrations. Because the Greek word used there, which I'm not going to attempt to pronounce, and I didn't bring you on the source sheet, the Greek word used in those cases to mean tent and tent pitching is actually a Greek word that's used in the Greek translations of the Torah that we have, both to mean the word Mishkan, so it's a translation of the word Mishkan into Greek, and it's also a translation of the word Sukkot into Greek. So some people look at this and they say, this is talking about the Chanukata Mishkan. What was the Feast of Tent Pitching? When they pitched the tent, meaning the Mishkan, And it's a celebration of the inauguration of the Beit HaMikdash, of the Mishkan again. And that's where we get sort of Chanukat HaBayit, or Chanukat HaMishkan, really. And other people look at this and they say, no, it's referring to Sukkot. So you can see how it goes both ways. Certainly, though, we do have the historical record over here that they did carry some form of greenery around while they celebrated during that first Chanukah. And really, one could say that that was the extent to which it modeled Sukkot. And beyond that, really, it didn't. However, there definitely is a connection here. So it's easy to see why it could be translated as inauguration of the tabernacle. It's easy to see how it could be translated as Sukkot. Nevertheless, there certainly is this important connection. And this Sefer Makabim Beit, and the legends, or really the stories contained within it, are actually found in a variety of other sources, including things called Midrash Chanukah, and it also has a number of other names. One of it is Sefer Chashmonaim or Sefer Chashmonaim. That's likely what the Aruch HaShulchan had access to when he made this statement about it being modeled after Sukkot. So this is all very nice. So we have our sort of postponed Sukkot. We fulfilled the title of this year. When Sukkot was postponed, Sukkot could not be celebrated at its correct time, and now it's been moved, again, to whatever degree that it was celebrated as, at the very least, with some forms of greenery parading around in the temple, which Sukkot, of course, is a holiday that certainly we celebrate that. So, we've been Yotze, the title, we fulfilled that. But what can we learn from this? And is there something specifically about Sukkot that we can take from this parallel and from the way that Sukkot may have been envisioned in why it was chosen to be celebrated? Surely there may have been other festivals that were missed and we didn't immediately jump to make those up as soon as we regained control of the temple. For the sake of time, I'm going to skip over source number 5 here, which is simply the Talmud's retelling of the miracle of the oil, which we mentioned above in source number 5. I'm going to get back to it in a little bit. But again, it's worth being familiar with the sources. Yes, there are other connections. I see someone has messaged me privately. The first temple dedication, which was on Sukkot, which I think Rabbi Torchiner just mentioned in the previous year. But that's also something that people pull up. There are various other connections across Tanakh, actually. Visions, on certain days of the calendar and things like that. There are definitely more connections. But yes, there is that strong connection that goes back even further to the first temple dedication being on Sukkot, so a certain connection between regaining the temple and Sukkot. Thank you very much for adding that. What I wanted to talk about was a different idea that we see in various sources that discuss Sukkah. If we look at the Talmud in Masechet Sukkah, it cites the pasuk which tells us what we celebrate by going into booths or into huts on Sukkot. And the Torah tells us, "Leman yidu doratechem ki vasukot hoshavti et bnei Yisrael b'otzi otam eretz Mitzrayim." That I made, as we have in the translation. So again, the translation that uses tent pitching above was the New English translation of the Septuagint. I just wanted to keep it as vague as possible. There are others that identify it as Chanukah HaMizbeach or Sukkot, but I wanted to stay away from those. Getting back to source number 6 again, the Talmud asks, when the Torah says that Hashem says, "I made the children of Israel reside in Sukkot," there's a disagreement similar to what we saw above. And how do you understand tent pitchings? What tent is the Torah referring to when it says, "Ki basukot toshavti et bnei Yisrael"? So there's a disagreement. Rabbi Eliezer says, these were the ananei kavod, the clouds of glory that God encompassed the Jewish people in. They're obviously not literal Sukkot, but they were spiritual Sukkot. And these clouds of glory took care of everything, as we're told repeatedly in Torah and Midrashim. And Rabbi Akiva disagrees. He says, actually, Sukkot mamash asulam, the Jewish people set up their own tents. Just like we built Sukkot, they went and they probably didn't take their hammer and nails and wooden boards. They probably, just put up whatever they could find around them. They may have had some wood with them. And they built huts in the places where they camped to shelter them from the heat. That's what Rabbi Akiva says, and this is explained by Rashi in the next source. Again, ananei kavod hayu, these were clouds of glory. The booths that the verse said he housed them in the desert were the clouds of glory, or they were literal booths which they had to make because of the heat of the sun. And so perhaps we can suggest, based on a variety of sources that really develop this idea, one place in particular is Aruch HaShulchan, the beginning of Aruch HaYom 625, is what is the significance of this second view that the Jewish people made literal tents, literal huts, literal booths when they were in this situation in the desert? I mean, why would we be celebrating that? Why is that worthy of celebration at this point in time? It makes sense to celebrate some sort of thanksgiving to God for putting us and encompassing us in his wonderful clouds of glory. But why should we celebrate the fact that we made booths for ourselves to shelter us from the terrible elements of the desert? That doesn't sound like a reason for celebration. And various commentaries note that that simply is showing, of course, Hashem, even according to Rabbi Akiva, took care of our every need. And of course, we had our clouds of glory around us as well. However, and yes, there is a connection to the city of Sukkot as well, which again, we're not going to have the chance to talk to so much right now. But yes, these sources develop that it should have been. If you were to go into the desert, you'd say, oh my gosh, it's so hot here. I need some shade. And they should not have naturally survived even with their tents. Look at all the terrible things that were wandering around in the desert. The desert was a no good place. Yet, we're celebrating even though we did what we did when we put up those tents and God took care of us from there. We started with the tents and God says, you've put up your tents for shade and now I'm going to take care of your every need. It's still a similar celebration. We're simply emphasizing the terrible nature of the desert from which Hashem saves us and shelters us by showing, just like we built huts then and we needed to build huts, so too now we build huts. And the truth is, there is a verse which we recite as part of the davening on Rosh Hashanah, but one of the remembrances that we have from Yirmiyahu, and that's source number 8, and it really underscores this idea. Haloch bekarata beozne Yerushalayim limor. He's told, go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem, saying that what does Hashem say? Ka'amar Hashem, zacharti lach chesed neurayach ahavat kelulotayach. I remember for thee the affection of thy youth, the love of thine espousals. Hashem says, what do I remember? Lechtech acharai b'midbar be'eretz lo ziruah. How you followed me into the midbar, into the desert, into the wilderness, in a land which was not sown. This was some place that was desolate. It was some place that there were no prospects of life and no prospects of journeying through. Yet, says Hashem, I give credit to you, Klal Yisrael. Why? Because you followed me into this terrible place. And you can see actually in Yirmiyahu and other places throughout Tanakh as well, how they describe the desert in this negative way. And you can see in Aruch HaShulchan puts... Okay, I just see that some people are having a problem with the audio here, so I'm just going to try to mute everybody if that's okay. Thank you. So you can see not only in this verse in Yirmiyahu, but other verses in Yirmiyahu and elsewhere, as noted by many of the commentaries that develop this idea, that the Midbar was really this terrible place, and it was sort of Hashem remembering us and saying, I remember that you followed me into this terrible situation, into this desolate, unsown wilderness. And for that, says God, sort of, I have a sweet spot in my heart for you. And at the beginning, on Rosh Hashanah, we mention this and we say, Hashem, remember your chesed neurach, your havat kalulotach, that we followed you in the desert, God. And remember us for good, judge us in a positive way. And Yom Kippur, hopefully, by then we've asked for forgiveness. God does judge us based on this merit. And then comes Sukkot, and we say, you know what, God? We do it again 100 times. And we head out and we remember that. And that really, I think, is not only a parallel to Hanukkah, in which we have a similar idea where we said, listen, God, we're going to do what we can. We were in caves for Sukkot. So, you know, we're going to try to celebrate Sukkot to whatever level we're able to. We'll walk around with our wands and we'll thank you. That's one way. And when we look at the miracle of the oil, God, we only have enough oil for one day. So here, we'll put it in for one day. And God says, you know what? I'm going to do the rest. Thank you for starting, for putting in that first little bit of effort, but really more so for trusting in me to take it forward and to take care of it. You built your booths for yourself. Now I'm going to encompass you in my clouds of glory. And that's something that's redone on Sukkot. How? So here we jump to source number 9, and this is, if there was any question that was equivalent about another holiday to that question of the Beit Yosef in Hanukkah that we mentioned at the beginning, that's one very famous question about Hanukkah. There's an almost as famous question about Sukkot. Namely, as we just learned, the Torah tells us, we're remembering the Sukkot Behotzi otam eretz Mitzrayim, and Hashem took us out of Egypt. Why then don't we celebrate Sukkot sometime around Pesach time? Why, asks the Tur in source 625, as you can see at the top of page 32 in your source packets, do we celebrate it at this other time as we lead into the fall and the winter, 6 months away from when we left Egypt? And there are various answers given to this question, but we can answer that that's exactly the point. We are going outside into the rainy season, and we're building a little hut just like we did then. We're saying, Hashem, I want you to take care of the rest. And that's why there's this emphasis specifically about rain coming into the sukkah. If you see Tosfot at the beginning, in source number 10, the beginning of Masechet Sukkah, tells us that we know from other places around the Talmud and Sukkah, as well as Tanit, that if there's rain that falls on Sukkot, it's a negative omen. We don't want rain, and it talks about how if it's raining on the Jewish people, it's like God is pouring back the pitcher they have just given him on them. And Tosfot asks, why is it that we don't just make a really nice wooden roof on all of our Sukkot? If the roof has to be made out of wood, which we know, so take your panels and take your nails, hammer in the panels, and no rain will get through. Why should it be a bad sign? And Tosfot says that's just not the way it works. The schach actually has to be made in a temporary fashion, because this is really the point of Sukkot. After we've called in our favor and God's positive remembrance of us for following him in to the desert, all we could do in that circumstance was build our little huts, and then he says, I'm taking care of the rest. We run out there into the beginning of the rainy season, and we say, God, here we are just like back then in our flimsy little structure, which would let rain, and we're relying on you to keep us dry. We're relying on you to keep us safe. And that really is a lesson, as we said, of Sukkot, which comes from the lesson of Hanukkah. Both the lesson of Hanukkah with the miracle of the oil, where we just say, here we've got one day's worth of oil, God, you do the rest. And also from the retelling of the story, which we mentioned above in Makavim Bet, the postponed Sukkot, how appropriate it is that this message of Sukkot, of saying, God, we do a little bit and you take care of the rest. So too in that story, as we see here, during the Feast of Tents, they had been inhabiting in mountains and caves like wild animals. So when they came out, what did they do? They carried their wands and beautiful branches and fronds of palm and offered hymns of thanksgiving. Thank you, Hashem, for doing that again. Yes, all we could do was go out there and fight. And it was only with the help of Hashem that we took step number one, and God performed a miracle to allow us to continue. That is what we ask Hashem to remember, that we followed him on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and we re-celebrate doing it all over again on Sukkot. Thank you very, very much, and have a wonderful night.
Thank you so much.